Chuck, first of all, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Chuck, I had heard the name, and then when you particularly mentioned it, and your association with John Brennan, that only added to how badly I felt about the news. I mean, talk about John.
John Brennan is probably the reason why I'm in horse racing. I met him when I was 15 years old. We used to cut out of school early and run over to simulcasting at the Saratoga Harness Track, where he was a trainer. And John was a racetrack or a degenerate, like most of us were back then. And he wouldn't bet much, but he just would hang out at the races. And we got to talking, and he invited me back to the barn to kind of learn how to take care of horses and do stalls. Essentially, I was free labor.
Yeah.
I was about 15 years old, and I just was willing to do anything to get into the business, because I just, growing up in Saratoga, you just wind up either loving it or hating it, and I was on the loving it side. And he left not that long afterwards and went down to Roosevelt because his training career was starting to pick up. But the knowledge that I learned from him, I used the next summer to get a job working for Cherie DeVoe's dad, who gave me, my first real job. Actually paid me $40 a week, but it was $40 a week and lunch at lunch. That was my pay.
Well, lunch with you,
Yeah,
even back then.
they might have been better off doubling the 40, but we had always stayed in touch. When I decided to go to the University of Arizona, they had a orientation program in Manhattan, and my dad and I went down, and we wound up staying out in Long Island with John, and going over to the races a couple times. And when I,
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt Raceway, yeah, the last days of Roosevelt, basically. And when I was looking to do an internship, after my second year at Arizona, John had said, "What about Yonkers? I'll talk to the guys in the racing office," and he set that up, and I wound up actually not only doing an internship but working there for several years as an assistant racing secretary. When I went into the Thoroughbreds, he was always a John had kind of started in the Thoroughbreds. He'd worked some security because he was from Rockaway, and then kind of went over to the Standardbreds. But he always was a Thoroughbred. He always kind of watched things, and he wasn't following it, closely, but he paid attention to the big races. And when I went on my own, I got a lot of business advice from John. Alan Jerkins is a great horse and one of the greatest horsemen that ever walked the earth. But you ask him about a business question, and you get that look like, "Let's go pick weeds." He just didn't want to talk about it. But John and I had always been, friends, and for years and years and years. And he had had some health issues. John was a big man, and he had had the stomach surgery, and he had been sick off and on. And by chance, I was flying to Saratoga this past summer on late notice, and wound up flying into Newark the same afternoon as the Hamiltonian. And I said, "Well, let me go over there and hang out there for a little bit." And I texted him. I said, "You don't happen to be over here for the race?" He's like, "Yeah." So we met up, and we hung out for a couple hours, and talking about the old days, and eating. We ate a lot, and he introduced me to some of the newer people. And John's one of those guys you walk around the track with, and he knows everybody. And he had a sharp comment for people, and he was just a likable guy. And I didn't know that was going to be the last time that we'd ever talk or I'd ever see him. Actually, he called me a couple weeks ago, and we talked for about 5 minutes. And he was asking how it was going with the new job and such. And he had gotten a call he had to take, and he never called back, and I never called back, and that was the last time I ever spoke to him. And I saw early yesterday morning the post that he had passed, and then, you know, as the news came out that it was the coronavirus, and they have a really big problem at Yonkers, and a lot of people are sick. And, you know, the one thing about the harness business is the people, they race all over the place. They don't, they're coming into contact with a lot of people from all over. The drivers are driving at four or five different tracks, and it's just, you know, it's so easily spread apparently. And I mean, you don't even know you have it. And, it's tough for a person like John, who had a compromised immune system, who was not yet 70. I think he was turning 70 this year, but you know, it kind of hits home how scary this really is for those people. I mean, people like me who don't get sick and don't have a compromised immune system, you don't realize that the fact is that you could be the carrier of it. And I don't want to really get into that whole thing, but it just makes you wonder about what's going to happen at Keeneland, what's going to happen at the Derby and the Triple Crown events with all these cancellations and you know, playing in front of no fans, and the, I mean, from a horse standpoint, running the races in front of nobody, the horses probably will be fine. I mean, it's not like the crowd brings anything to the actual action on the racetrack, but the amount of revenue that the Triple Crown events create for the for Churchill Downs, for the Stronach Group, and for Naira, to lose that is going to be very, very difficult. And I just don't know, like, where we're going. I mean, none of us do. It's just kind of scary times. But, you know, it kind of put a face on it. And it's someone, I mean, not only that I knew, that was a person that changed my life. And to see them go with this, I mean, people die every day from different things. A friend of mine was talking to me this morning about how sad she was that a friend of hers who's 34 years old's got breast cancer, and, you know, healthy person that works out that you would never believe would be sick, and it can happen at any time. But, you know, this, you know, the hysteria, some of it apparently is not misguided, but. But John was a really good guy. He was a good spokesman. He was a, you know, people didn't always agree with his stances, but he was respectful, and he was straightforward. And a lot of times it's not politically correct to advance horsemen's rights. Obviously, this week is probably a week where that's going to fall upon deaf ears in a lot of ways. But it just was kind of a shock.
And, you know, waiting for an update on Joe Feraldo, who was exhibiting symptoms and was waiting for, I guess, a testing result, too. It's
scary. Yeah, Joe is a healthy guy. I mean, he's still driving in amateur races. I think he's 74 years old, but it just goes to show you how this thing can spread. I mean, just you know, being in close contact, and, you know, for the people that are in danger, they really have to be careful. And we have to, the people that aren't not technically in danger of really dying or getting, you know, ghastly sick, we have to be aware that about the contact that we come into with those people. And it's just something that, you know, in the world today, personal responsibility seems to be a little bit of a lost art, and we just have to be careful. That's, and I don't know what else that, you know, I could say about that.
Well, I feel terrible, and I even as you're talking, Chuck, I just heard from John Panetta, a Facebook friend, and he mentions remembering being with you.
He was one of the crew. We were kids at the harness track. We were 15, 16 years old, and I mean, to us it was the greatest thing in the world. And John was you know, he was a fun guy, and he made fun of us, and, you know, we made fun of him. And there was a whole crew of us: Shawnee, Rico, there's just a bunch of us that, you know, have still, you know, keep in contact all these years later. And that's what's one of the things, that's one of the great things about horse racing is the social interaction that you have, and you know, the difference of opinions and being right, being wrong, and that kind of thing. And you know, you make friends forever. But you know, it's like I said, it's kind of a tough week for racing in general. So, but
This adds, you know, from the other side of the aisle on the standard Brit side, Chuck. And regarding that, let's spend we got about 40 minutes, and let's, you know, talk about what transpired here in the last 36 hours. And, you know, part of it, Michael Tomlinson wrote to me. Michael is going to visit probably tomorrow, because he, you know, like you, a small to medium size outfit, and he wants to provide perspective on this. Of course, yesterday, Graham Motion, very outspoken and emotional about things. Your take as to what transpired and how it relates to, you know, why you moved into the horseman side of, you know, track operation.
Well, let me tell you, those two guys are both stand-up guys. They speak from the heart, and whether you agree with them or you don't agree with them, you know where they stand on the issues. Graham is a friend of mine. He was the last trainer to ever send me horses. He sent me three horses. I think it was two falls ago that they were having issues with the rain, and we trained for a common owner, and he said, you know, these horses would probably be better down in South Florida, and he sent them down, which is something that just doesn't happen very often. Trainers seem to hold on to horses and not, you know, said they'll send assistants or literally just send the grooms with them, but, you know, he's a very stand-up guy, and he is adamant in his beliefs, and he walks the walk. The fact that he had gotten himself into an issue in Kentucky with medication when they had, you know, he had clearly followed the guidelines, that was a really a case that was, you know, telling to me. And you know, we segue into yesterday's events, or the day before's event. I don't even know what day it is today. What day is today? Wednesday? All right, a couple of days ago, you know. In that, there's so much, there's so many places to go, and certainly this has been a day that's been coming. It's not, I said to someone yesterday, I said, the biggest surprise to me is that the FBI investigated trainers before they investigated the sales, because I always thought that with some of the shenanigans that were always played there, that seemed to be the low-hanging fruit. But they're here, and it's pretty damning. I have questions about some of the statements that they've made. It's a little ambiguous as to what. I never thought I would say this, but I'm actually in favor of having one racing commission for all of racing. And I think one of the problems, you know, as I saw it, was that how could we ever get enough political clout to make it and do it right? Where I just never thought that we would get that. And I don't like the bill that's passed. I think it gives way too much influence to wealthy people who can make unknown, you know, behind-the-scenes donations to the USADA. The USADA has zero experience in animals. The scope of racing, if you think of all of the tracks that we're talking about, and you think about a Saturday in the summer, there's 30 or 40 tracks running, and they're going to have to cover all of them, and it's just an unwieldy thing. But I think one of the reasons I quit training wasn't just that I couldn't compete. It was that we didn't know what the rules were anymore. In a lot of ways, they've changed rules from place to place, and we just don't even know what they are. it's hard to follow what is okay and what is not okay. And like this Medivet product, it was brought to my attention in 2014, I believe. And it seems like a legitimate company with legitimate products that was used overseas in jurisdictions that are, you know, that test heavily. There was never any substances that were in these that were supposedly, you know, on a banned list or not, you know, you weren't supposed to use. And the way it's described as the usage of it is it actually helps heal the horse, regenerate
cell growth.
Right. And that would seem to be extremely beneficial. So I just have a hard time grasping, and I understand all the other things that went on here. I mean, I'm picking out one little thing of the whole, you know, the scope of all the issues that existed. Obviously, it's unacceptable. There was a lot of things going on, but it just seems like there might be more to the story than what that indictment said, because certainly any use of their products certainly didn't work for me. I mean, I've done so poorly the last few years that I couldn't really even attract any owners, and that was part of the problem. Was I just, you know, you try to do things on the up and up, and you just can't get people to send you horses, and they say, you know, you're not winning enough. And I mean, I'll be honest, I'll be frank, I had a veterinarian tell me, this was years ago, that one of the problems that I had, I couldn't get any of his clients to send me horses because I never got any positive tests. And I said, well, isn't that a good thing? He says, no, they don't think you're trying hard enough. And this is 2002, 2003, 2004. We're not talking last year. That's the attitude of some of these people. And some of the people we're talking about are very big owners. We're not talking about nickel dime guys who have one horse or two horses or own a third of a 10 claimer. We're talking about guys who are influential. I had an owner that I had done very well for call me up and ask me point blank, are we on the cutting edge? And I said, well, the only way I can answer that is that we are on the cutting edge of legal. We you know, as far as we can do. I mean, and I'm a guy that I tried every therapy machine. I've tried every kind of supplement. I mean, I'm willing to be open-minded and try things to help. And the fact of the matter is, hay, oats, and water doesn't work because horses get sick and horses have infirmaries and horses tie up. And there's things that go on with horses. They're not, you know, the idea that the horse, thoroughbred race horses don't need anything else to help them overcome whatever the issues that they have is just a false one. And, you know, vets, racetrack vets and trainers have been demonized by certain groups for the last year and the last, you know, decade. And obviously these two people are going to be held up as proof that they were right. But I'm not I've been kind of pessimistic. I was pessimistic on this show when we were doing the first couple times we did this. And I'm losing enthusiasm for the business. And I just lost my enthusiasm for training. I just didn't feel like I had a fair chance. I got tired of hearing people, you know, wanting to give me horses and not pay and you know, be on deals and I wasn't willing to really go and you know, to do things that would harm horses. I haven't had a horse break down in a race in at least 15 years. At least the last two horses that I had that were injured fatally under my care were both unraised two-year-olds, one of which had a bone deformation that we had no idea up in his upper femur. And he actually broke his leg in his first workout going 25 seconds. And when the vet, you know, opened the leg up, it was all brittle. He had had some sort of issue, a genetic issue that we had no clue that he had. And another one was a horse that hurt her shoulder working on the turf, an unraced horse. So, you know, I've always been conservative. I've always been someone that didn't push the envelope. I didn't take chances. And that's not really what a lot of these people care about. Those aren't characteristics that appeal to a lot of the owners, especially the owners that are willing to pay. And a lot of them look at it as an investment, and you're not winning a high enough percentage. And the fact that you rehome your horses and your horses don't wind up in slaughterhouses doesn't matter. The fact that you don't have fatal injuries doesn't matter. The fact that you're trying to, you know, do things the proper way doesn't matter. And it just seemed like an uphill battle.
A lot of what you just, you know, what you just laid out, you know, particularly on the, you know, on the ownership side, I mean, that storyline or that dialogue certainly coming to the fore out of, you know, out of this, given, you know, given some of the owners involved, it's a complex, in some cases, it's particularly complex. I'll actually bring up Ron Lombardi, frankly, because he's been working with Jason Service for I think almost 15 years. So it's not like he came running to Jason Service when Service started to win more races and get better horses. I mean, he'd been with him really from the start, more or less. But there's some owners that that are acting Chuck like they're shocked to see that there was cheating going on or however you want to characterize what has transpired, and that's not being bought, frankly, by the horse playing community and the public at large. I mean, those that watch, basically we said yesterday in conversation, I mean, the suspicions that you have, you can have, but until there's a mechanism that confirms things and brings, prosecutorial forces against it, what are you supposed to do? I mean, other than just allude to those that may be taking an edge.
I know. Perception is reality. And that's something that I've said to people 1,000 times over the last 15 years. Perception is reality. The perception is there's things going on that don't make sense. I see it. I've said it. I've talked about it. There's trainers that win races at extreme rates that when you talk to him, you think, how does this guy find his car every day, And he just seems like he's so much smarter than everyone else. He's not even, he seems like he's a moron, but yet here he is, winning races. And I mean, and to be honest, Jason Service is he's been in my barn for 4 years at Palm Meadows. He had one side of the barn. We had the other side of the barn. And actually, to be honest, 2 years ago, I requested that they put him there because he runs a good barn. His help is, they don't mess around. They're not drinking. The horses are well cared for. From the outside, it looks like a model operation. It's clean. The horses look good. But the thing is that I know someone that bought a horse from him a couple years ago, and I said, are you sure? And he's like, well, he told me all the things wrong with him. I said, I understand that, but the guy does, unusually well, and he can't do well with the horse. So, I don't know if I'd be, when he bought the horse, he did nothing with the horse, obviously. But, and maybe the horse was just slow. I mean, that's it, too. But, it's you know, the, in a lot of ways, the bettors were right. And like you said, the irony of some of the horses that these horses, the trainers that these horses are being transferred to, I mean, without, you know, saying names, there's a couple guys that win at extraordinary rates. And you just wonder, and I'll be honest, I'll be frank. It's easier now to win an extraordinary rate than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Touch on that, Chuck, because it's a point worth mentioning, and we didn't get too much into it with Matt Hegarty yesterday. I kind of alluded to that and elsewhere.
Listen, this is not a defense of anything. It's just the facts is that, you know, you field sizes are smaller, and the rich are richer and the poor are poorer. And the mid-sized stables, the Mike Tomlinsons, those guys, they don't have the gun power to fight these guys. And so you know, the other thing is that as the game contracts, the power that certain stables hold to get races written for them, and to get the circumstances that they need, that helps as well. And I'm saying this is not a defense in any way, shape, or form, but there are some trainers that have these unbelievably good records, unusually good, and it was always odd to me that they would do good no matter where their horses were. They might have an assistant in a location that the head guy doesn't actually go to very often, if at all, and they do just as well as the main string. And you know, it just is. It's tough to put into words without just, you know, purely pointing fingers, but anybody that wins 25% or more every year, and you just, nowadays, from here on in, how do you not question that? I mean, how do you not question it? And that's the problem that I see going forward. I was at a meeting with, I'm on the board of the HVPA. We had a meeting with some of the Stronic executive yesterday about a you know, wide variety of topics, and including, you know, what's going to happen after the Calder you know, situation is, because this is going to be it for that this year will definitely be the last year. But you know, one of the things I said, you know, I just don't know. I don't envy you guys, because I just don't know how you're going to promote racing in this current atmosphere. With all the negativity that's happened, and, you know, to just kind of, you know, brush off everything and say, hey, you know, everything's awesome. You know, we got rid of these two guys, but this isn't going to solve the problem. And, you know, part of the problem is that the game has contracted, and the strong have got stronger and the weak have got weaker. And any business, any project, anything, your weakest link is where you have to that's where the most danger falls, and the danger is that guys like me, you know, we give up. I mean, I sat at a table yesterday, and Billy Badgett and I were laughing. There's a picture I have, 1999, the Saratoga standings, and Billy was like 7th and I was like 10th. And, you know, here we are now. Neither of us are deemed worthy of training horses anymore. We're not good enough. We, you know, got into some other things, and Billy's done great. I mean, Billy's done a great job for the HVPA in the short time he's been there. And he did an excellent job over at, you know, in his time as an executive for the racetrack. And I'm not saying that he made a wrong choice. I mean, honestly, I'm sure he's making way more money than he was the last few years when he trained, when he struggled to find horses. But there's so many different issues, and this business is so poor at really addressing them. I mean, we can't have a straight conversation with some of the anti-Lasix people, because they don't want to have a conversation. And if you want to get rid of Lasix, fine, but that's not going to help things. It's going to make it worse. I mean, does anybody really think that that Lasix is getting rid of Lasix is going to make the 32% guys go away. It's not. It's not going to do anything. It's just going to make it harder for trainers, for normal guys to treat horses that bleed. And that's to say that we should just, you know, retire all of them that bleed. And I mean, we're going to have match races. It's not going to, you know, it just is an industry. We do such a poor job, and it's just frustrating to me, Steve. And that's really what, I mean, I love this business, and I wanted to do it. This was the only thing I wanted to do. Well, I mean, I wanted to play in the NBA, but I didn't grow quite enough. But, you know, this has been my life's work, and now I see it falling apart. And I don't know that there's anyone out there in this business, a big enough, strong enough personality to really fix it, to make people say, hey, you know what? You're going to have to compromise. You're going to have to give in a little bit. You're going to have to, you know, stop sticking your toes in and saying, I'm only going to have X trainer train my horse and send him 50. And then another guy sends him 50. And another guy sends him 50. And, you know, Kieran McLaughlin, he finally had enough. And, you know, Kieran's, obviously his situation is unique, and everyone's is unique. You know, he has health issues, and I'm sure that he would prefer to stay in the house he's lived in for 25 years and the circuit he's been on, and not have to relocate to Kentucky and Monmouth and all that. But the fact of the matter is that was kind of a scary thing. And Gary Contessa, who's been a mainstay for years, regardless of people's feelings about these people, whether they like them or they don't like them. I mean, these guys were solid trainers with solid, you know, not solid, with big outfits. And they can't, they don't feel like they can make it anymore. And between the labor board, the insurance, the rules, and this is one of the things people say, well, you know, what do you mean? I said the rules are they built rules on top of rules on top of rules, where, you know, you're so hamstrung, you don't know how to fix things anymore, because you don't know if it's okay or if it's not okay. And, you know, some things are enforced, some things are not enforced. And it gets to be such a, you know, people just don't understand. There's not a rule book that they give you and says, okay, this is the rules. This is what you can do. This is what you can't do. And then if you do wrong, then you're like, okay, well, you knew what the rules were. In a lot of ways, we don't know what the rules are. And that's one of the things that I've said so many times. Like, they have these stacking penalties, right, for in Florida. I guess they have them other places, where if you have a detectable level of 2 NSAIDs, you still get a positive test, even if it's way, way, way underneath the threshold. So it's like, okay, I understand the reasoning for the rule. You don't want trainers giving 2 anti-inflammatories instead of 1. But you can get dragged into that so easily because it's just simple detection level. It could be the most minuscule detection of anything. It's because it's something that you stopped 5 days before, you know, well within the 24-hour or 48-hour period, and you still wind up with a bad test. And in this atmosphere, no one's going to believe you. No one's going to believe that you actually, you know, didn't do this on purpose, or the benefit that a horse was actually nothing, and that it's just the randomness of sometimes of a millionth of a gram testing that guys who really try to do the right thing get dragged into it. And I think that it's just it's difficult. But I believe the racetrack management has to take a lot of the blame, because they don't listen to their players. They haven't listened to their players. They haven't listened to the trainers and the owners that complain. That's one of the biggest fallacies out there on in the Twitterverse, is that the trainers and owners don't complain about other trainers and owners that win at obscene rates and do magical things. That complaint, no, trust me, my clients are all trainers. No group of people in the world complain more than horse trainers. They complain about everything. They complain about the size of the shavings, the this, the that, this and that. I mean, they complain literally about everything. And I know for a fact that when some of these guys have gone on these streaks, that the management has gotten pounded with complaints, but they never really did anything. The only guy that did anything was the guy at the Meadowlands. And I completely disagree with his attitude on marketing, that it should come from purse money, and I don't agree with that at all. But as to his willingness to claim his product as his own and to not allow certain participants in, I have to say that was a smart move. And honestly, I've always been waiting for a thoroughbred track to come out and do this. And I've said this to quite a few executives at racetracks. If you were the guy that came down as the hard ass, the we're not going to let this guy on, you know, and property rights, blah, 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 whatever. He's suspicious. Are the people who put the money through the windows, they believe he's suspicious. They don't want to bet on races he's in. The other trainers don't want to be in the races he's in. The other owners don't want to be in the races he's in. Let's just say we would prefer that you didn't come here. We used to do it at Yonkers, mostly to drivers, but we used to do it. But I just think that you would benefit. I think the benefit of perhaps losing some owners and some losing some trainers, you would get more people, you would get other ones to come. I think that your product would be considered a cleaner product, and you would benefit financially from it. And I know that there's, you know, I know racetracks especially are loath to be sued. No one wants to be sued. They got to spend money being sued. But it's and you run into the question of how much do some of these racetracks really want to be racetracks. How much do they really want to commit to racing? And, you know, we see all kinds of conversations on social media the last couple of days about, okay, what can we do and where's the money going to come from to do this and that? Well, the FBI is the FBI. We're never going to be able to do as the FBI does. I mean, God knows how much money was spent in this investigation. And in the end, they're getting, you know, most of the charges are misbranding.
Right.
It's not, you know, race fixing or this or that. It's misbranding and it just is. I don't know how any. I mean, when the tracks are the ones who stopped funding the TRPB,
that came up yesterday. That with Alan Foreman, with Peter Berube's father, Paul Berube, and you know, in fact, John Parada called me the other night, Monday night, and said, you know, when TRPB was, you know, the boots on the ground and the Pinkerton type concept, that they had an ear on the rail, and you know, they were preempting things, and you know, there's always going to be the latest, the newest, et cetera, you know, designer drug and other, you know, other hijinks. I mean, the money involved makes people do things that they shouldn't be doing. But, you know, there's a valuable lesson, you know, looking backwards that way, too.
No doubt. I mean, listen, the TRPB wasn't the end all of end alls. I mean, it was.
But it was a. But
the TRPB
it
was around when Oscar Barrera was claiming horses.
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of hinting at.
I mean,
yes,
it's not everything, but what I'm saying is that the boots on the ground deterrent was at least, you know, was there in some ways, and a lot of it just comes down to funding, and it comes down to the will of the people. And I think that there's occasions where these two trainers that were arrested yesterday, they're kind of Johnny come latelys to the top of the game. 5 years ago, those guys had mostly claiming horses. It's just recently that they've gotten to be, you know, have horses in Dubai and you know, the Breeders' Cup and the bigger races, the Derby, obviously. But I think if something were to hit someone who's been established at that level, I think that would be a, you know, an even tougher pill to swallow.
Right.
And I don't know that. I mean, I don't. And this is the one thing people say, well, you know, the clean trainer should. I said, well, what is the guy supposed to do? When a vet who's a legitimate vet who works for a lot of legitimate outfits goes in a guy's barn and gives a horse a shot, you know, it could be an antibiotic for all, you know. I mean, it's not like they have these vials of with skull and crossbones on them. And it's why, you know, a lot of times veterinarians are called shake them down. They'll stop a vet randomly and they'll pull different substances from their trucks and send them off for testing, and then, you know, just to make sure they don't have
right.
it. But that's like finding a needle in a haystack, you know. But I don't know. I'm just kind of... you might have seen horses taken from one place, and they're going to go to another guy who might wind up in 2 weeks from now might wind up in the same place. It's just you don't even know, and that's why. It's like I said, I don't believe in the USADA. I think what they've done in boxing is a joke. I mean, boxing laughs at them, and if boxing laughs at you, obviously you have some issues. But I think that there's having one set of rules, having defined clear rules, and also allowing for people to properly treat their horses, to not to make it so restrictive that we can't actually help the horse in need. But that's needed, and I don't know how to do it, and I don't know what the path is, and I don't know that. The money exists, and I mean, this business is shrinking. It's not getting bigger. I think that taxing the bettors would be, you know, would be like, it just would be unbelievably naive to think that they're not going to, they're going to accept putting the, you know, paying the bill for this. Purses aren't all that great outside of places that have alternate gaming, like Oak Lawn and New York and a couple of the other places that are getting a tremendous amount of money from that. But it's not that easy to move money. You know, you're having to go to legislations and move things, and they're more likely to take it than to use it.
No, and the fight going on in Pennsylvania. Chuck, we've got about, I don't know, maybe 4 minutes. Because we try to provide answers, not just to questions that are, you know, that are pending, but also, you know, solutions. Let's float one, because you're in a position with the horsemen right now. The topic that, if I did a search to find out when Frank Stronach himself first floated, I think it was actually the same time that he floated the initial Pegasus as a race concept, the commissary or the pharmacy, the on-track pharmacy, where vets would have to sign out prescriptions specifically, could not bring anything on to the backstretch themselves, that it would have to be procured from a racetrack pharmacy. Is that a step in the right direction and a viable, you know, measure?
In theory it is, but in practicality it makes it difficult. Sure, we could do that at Gulfstream, we could do that at Keeneland, Belmont, Churchill, but what about Thistle Downs, or what about Tampa Bay Downs, what about these other small tracks? Because that's going to be a considerable expense for the racetrack to take on. I know that there's technical things, maybe some of the basics that the vet would need to treat a colic, for instance, that you wouldn't want, if you had a horse colicking, your vet to have to go stand in line, and maybe he's fifth in line to, you know, behind the pharmacy. Cause you know, you go to a pharmacy, it's you know, they don't say, hey, you know, here's my prescription, and 45 seconds later they jump. I mean, if you have to wait for your prescription, you might wait, you know, God knows how long, because of all of the protocols that any licensed pharmacist is going to have to go through. But, you know, the backside's a 7-day-a-week job. We don't take Sundays off. Horses get sick on Sundays. Horses get hurt on Sundays. Horses,
right.
You know, do all those things. So the cost, the expense, because you would have to have multiple pharmacists. You would have to have security. You would have to have a building. You would have to absolutely. Well, you would have to buy the products from.
Of course,
you know, so
an inventory. Right. But well, then as another solution or as another alternative measure, which I know has been done in spots, the concept of a ride along, that essentially any vet van that comes on the track, somebody's riding along and essentially recording anything that's being administered.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if federal indictments aren't enough to make people clean up their act, I just don't know. Like,
yeah, fair point.
I mean, it's just and I know everyone's already convicted them, but like when you go and you get a lawyer and you go into to court, I mean, different things happen. So who knows what the end result is going to be. But, I mean, those aren't bad ideas, but I think the attitude of people has to change. And that starts at the ownership level, and it starts at the ownership level of racetracks, and it starts at the ownership level of horses. You know, if you're just going to continue to give your horses to the guy with the highest percentage, and if you're just going to continue to give more stall space to the guy who has the highest percentage because he's attracting all the owners, then you're just telling all the other trainers, well, you know, keep up with the Joneses or fade away. And, you know, people like me have kind of faded away.
Chuck Simon, everybody. Cannon Shell on Twitter, of course, and Industry Answers back starting, and good timing for it as well. Chuck, thanks.
Anytime, Steve.
We going to see you? Are you coming up to OBS?
No.
All right. I'll try to figure out a way to see you.
I try to stay out of Ocala. I may be depressed and I may be like negative right now, but if I see a horse I like, I'm still going to wind up freaking buying them.
I love it. Chuck, thank you.
See you later.
Chuck Simon, everybody. Earlier, of course, Sid with Sire Watch. Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale. John Secure will join us tomorrow. We checked in with Pete as well from Cheltenham earlier. And I'm forgetting something. Talk to you in the morning.